Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org, because don't you always hear about the best stuff in life through word of mouth? You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. And I'm your host, Leyte. When I'm not on the air, I make a living connecting people, bopping around town, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, restaurateurs, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. And I'd like to wish Chef Jason Fox and his team happy fifth birthday to their beloved restaurant, Commonwealth, in San Francisco, which was one of the first starting that fine dining-ish food in casual environments kind of thing. And SF is buzzing about his new spot, Oro, soon to open in Mint Plaza, featuring the use of the whole animal, large plates, small plates to share. And interestingly, a tasting menu of off-menu family-style dishes. In my humble opinion, Jason does some of the most zany umami-bomby food around. And I caught him for a chat in December 2015 at our friend, the chef Brendan McHale's East Village spot called The Eddie for drinks and bites. And with Jason, we'll talk bone marrow and bar tartine beginnings. And this clip that I'd like to share with you starts off with a reminisce of a time cooking with Brendan. Small world. Let's do it.
It was pouring. Yeah, it was a summer pouring hailstorm. Where I actually had to. I think I had to have my partner, who was also there in my front of the house doing stuff. Mm-hmm. I had to have her go actually bring in an extra set of clothes for me. we were walking around in the pouring rain. But it's great because we get. I think I was saying before, everyone always kind of complains about the New York or people in San Francisco.
Yeah, you compare, can be totally open with us.
Yeah, people in San Francisco compare the New York farmers market to San Francisco and. I really like the New York farmers market, actually sometimes a little bit more, because there's different greens, there's different herbs, mm-hmm. there's maybe not 19 types of peaches,
yeah.
but there's one of everything enough. So for that dinner, I think we did like two courses where, you know, some stuff we brought in, which was kind of featuring like our food, and then two courses we just wanted to like, you know, highlight local stuff.
Right.
And we just went and just grabbed a bunch of vegetables, and I think we did like a salad and maybe another vegetable dish, just kind of highlighting the New York farmers market.
So was this tasting table dinner just you, or were there other chefs in collaboration?
No, it was just me. It was a tasting table who we've known, or I know a bunch of the people there.
Awesome. It's a beautiful publication.
Yeah. And then, you know, the editor at the time, Scott Hocker, mm-hmm. Who used to write for SF Magazine and stuff, just asked us to come out and cook. So I think we cooked for 30 people.
Excellent.
Like a five-course menu. So.
And what are we having here cocktail-wise? So I'm gonna tell you about mine. So I got the Francis de Mute. It has Nika whiskey, Luxardo Amaro, Petrol, Vodka. It's an Eastern European.
Such a
Christmassy tasting. I can't do it. It's like I fail. I failed. Pedro Jimenez, sherry aromatic bitters, and I chose to have a whole egg in it because, like, hello.
It's like the holiday
short
season.
Yeah.
It's like eggnog.
It tastes so amazing. How
do
about you?
Do you like eggnog?
I love eggnog. I'm a sucker for eggnog. I will get eggnog. Can I just admit this is a guilty pleasure?
That's better than any eggnog I've ever had.
I'll do the thing where I buy the high quality eggnog off of the shelf.
You get the box, like those little cartons.
I get the one in the fridge section of Whole Foods. I know, I'm such a bad person. And then I have like some kind of bottle of something alcoholic, and I'll just sit at home and like.
What does it traditionally have? Eggnog,
cream,
rum.
Egg,
is it rum? What's the
rum,
traditional alcohol?
Yeah, I think that's traditional. I'm not a pro.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a pro. Okay.
But I did a couple weekends ago. I had Jane Elkins, who is a very talented bartender. She came in my special request. You know, she was going to do, like, a champagne cocktail. And I was like, no, you're going to come and make eggnog. That's what I want, your contribution to my dinner party.
Nice.
To me.
Nice. Cool.
Do you like eggnog?
I like the idea of it. I don't know if I've had examples of it. But,
what is it that you don't like about it? Typical
it's
eggnog.
Sweet and tastes like melted ice cream base that like sits that you try when you're making ice cream. I don't like things overly sweet, so I think more of the I don't even know if it's commercial if they make a lot of it, but sometimes I always try it somewhere and it's not. It's kind of sweet and gross.
But got it. I understand.
This is very good, though.
Okay, so what are you having?
What do I have? I have a King Rodney, which has bourbon, sherry, and saffron. So I'm a sucker for anything bourbon.
That is, and saffron. I'm a sucker
and
for anything saffron.
Oh, I love saffron.
Yay! And we're getting some tastes of something.
This is Barnstable Petite Oysters, which is located right here on Cape Cod. Anyways,
right
this
there.
Is a yeah, right there on the inner bay. Really beautiful. I mean, this bay gets like 50% to 60% exchange of like fresh water per tide. It's like there's like these couple bays with that and Duxbury are just like really really clean oysters. Anyways, we took a little Mutsu apple, juiced it, a little bit of chamomile vinegar, then froze it. So it's a Mutsu apple and chamomile vinegar ice.
Do you make your own chamomile vinegar?
Yeah. We've just gotten an insane amount of flowers before, like they came and then you know
preserve it all
and basically that and honey.
Oh, nice.
And, like, 5 gallons of it.
Oh, cool.
So it's
sweet.
Looks like a bomb's gonna go off downstairs. But yes. Cool.
Awesome.
All right. Cheers.
Wow. So let's try these oysters. Mmm.
That's nice.
Wow.
The chamomile.
That's pretty. Okay. So, how long are you going to be in town for?
I'm here till Sunday. So.
And, on the SF front, you've got like a greenhouse going on, right?
Oh, yeah.
On the roof?
On the roof. So, we have a greenhouse. So, we were just talking about honey. We have bees, too. So, we've been harvesting. We've done 2 harvests of our honey so far and had got about 7 gallons of honey, which is awesome.
That's amazing.
We started a greenhouse during the summer and then got like 40, 50 sprouts going. We've got another 40 different plants going, so it's pretty cool.
So
I feel like I spend more time being a farmer or gardener than a cook sometimes. And my cooks are downstairs working, and I come in with like bags of soil and then go upstairs and kind of spend time in my garden.
You basically are a chef with a dream job, which is honestly I feel like everybody wants to go do the farmer thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, for us, we have our space is actually small, but it's a freestanding building, so we have the whole roof, and then it connects with the building behind. So we started moving into their space a little bit, but we've got a pretty sweet footprint that we can do our garden. So during the summer, we have all these plants going, and then as the summer was ending, we built a greenhouse up there. We put grow lights up there in our greenhouse, which is to kind of supplement light, which has been great. And it's
why is the light not good?
Because we're in between buildings.
Got it.
So as the sun, so during spring and summer, we get this perfect like 12 hours of like great direct sunlight, and we were growing flowers and herbs, and growing some smaller vegetables. And then as fall and winter came, the sun moved behind the building next to us, and we've got about 6 months before it's going to come back there. So we're just looking to like supplement light, and we just added electricity and put some grow lights up there where people, my prep cooks asked me for growing motel, which we're not, but to all outside appearances there's a glowing greenhouse on our roof. People wonder, at least no one can get up there though without like grappling hooks, so it's safe in the mission.
How many years old is Commonwealth? Like 2?
4.5.
4.5.
hour and a half.
Gosh.
Yeah.
It's like, it, you know, when I walk in there, it feels so fresh. Like,
yeah, four and a half, which
you're
is...
Like, you were ahead of the curve on, I mean, on the mission. Like, it's just, like, white hot right now.
Yeah, I mean, we opened in 2009. Okay. So after, 2008 was
rough.
When rough, things were rough around the country. We thought we were maybe a little bit more ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
Score treat, sorry.
A sweet.
Don't apologize.
So the beef tendon puff with charred onion cram and trout roe. It's a braised bacon, tater tot with pickle mustard seeds, pea puree. And this is a tea-cured smoked salmon rillette with malt chips.
Awesome.
Holy moly.
That's sweet.
Cheers, dudes.
Cheers. Can I take a picture?
I think I took you to the Commonwealth of the East Coast,
because
this kind of like feels very umami body,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, that's No, this is, I mean, this is why we hit it off so well when we, you know, cooked together before and we had, you know, a good rapport about a lot of this stuff.
Did you, when I suggested the Eddie, did you already know?
No, I just put it together as we were sitting here.
Really?
Like, the name looks really familiar. And then,
because I kept in touch with
Brendan for, you know, a little bit, and he had been out in San Francisco. And then, it was probably about 2 years ago, and I didn't put together that he had ended up here.
So then you started out in 2009.
Yes, started out 2009.
We're emerging from the doldrums.
Emerging from, and we're, you know, people were trying to be a quote-unquote creative restaurant when burgers and pizza seemed to rule the land at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we thought we were ahead of the curve. But also at that same time, a bunch of other restaurants, which, I mean, we're even happy to be considered in the same class of them or, you know, in the same breath sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're like, Venue, we opened the same day as Venue.
Really?
Yep.
That's like such a weird San Francisco trivia.
Yeah, which we love. I mean, I love Venue. Cezanne did their thing right before us. There was Prospect. There was like a 2 month period where all these restaurants that were, you know, trying to be not quite pizza and burgers opened at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but we're a little bit of a sketchier area, I guess, which people think.
Mm-hmm.
It does bother us, but we're trying to do...
Yeah, your food.
Trying to do fun, creative... I don't know if it's approachable. We try to be approachable, but not stratospherically priced. So,
it's utterly creative, though. And it's like there's, you know, flowers on the plate.
Yeah, well, we try to mix, you know, flowers on the plate. We grow a lot of it up top, on the roof. We just try to mix. I mean, fun, creative, and, you know, interesting. You know, for us, I love all the places. I love all types of food, but really at the time when we opened, there was a lot of, it was just Italian, and there was, we felt like the city wasn't really pushing what it should have, you know, as far as it should have been. So we're, you know, trying to do that, especially at like a approachable price point more than anything, you know, because all the places I love to go to, or I think are creative and do awesome things, charge a lot. And they're more special occasion, so we were trying to bring that aesthetic of fine dining and food at a more approachable, you know, price level.
And you did it like 3 years before, like, I mean, you know, similar likely delicious restaurants would be like Pearl and Ash or Estella.
Yeah,
you know, and
all friends of ours, and we like all those guys.
Love them.
Love all those guys. Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, Issa, he was doing that a little bit before.
Right.
It's always weird what our timeline is, because we really just try to make good food and really pay attention to what, you know, I mean, what other people are doing or how we're opening, and we just kind of, you know, our individual vision, which we hoped or thought was unique and people would like, and, you know, it's luckily people have liked it and we're still open, so.
So Mission Chinese just reopened here in New York.
Mission Chinese just reopened in New York.
And you...
Danny...
You worked with Danny...
I used to work with Danny. Danny used to work with us at Bar 13. Anthony, who did Mission Street Food, used to work with us.
Anthony Mint came on the show, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's such a fascinating guy.
He's a fascinating guy.
Like, quiet, thoughtful, like,
very quiet,
brilliant.
Thoughtful, yeah.
things? Are you going to be able to pop into
I might be seeing, well, they're closed tonight. Okay. I might see Danny tonight. Mm-hmm. Later on, I might see Danny later on in the week. But yeah, every time, I mean, that's actually our, like, Mission Cantina was our home base for the last year or two. When we came, we cooked at the Beard House in the summer, and we shipped everything to Mission Cantina. And, you know, so, yeah, we're all still very close. And, yeah.
Did you know Danny cooked on my roof, like, 3 years ago?
No.
Did I tell you that?
No.
Super New York moment. And I'm going to, like, tell you the story so you can eat that one bite I just had because it is bonkers. So, when I first moved into the apartment I'm in now, I had no furniture, and I was like, just on GChat, a friend of mine, Tanner Wally, was at the bar at Tawar for like 4 years, makes music, had a music video premiere party, venue fell through, he had no budget. I said, hey, you know what, I've got no furniture, why don't you do it in my apartment or on the roof, you know, of my apartment, which is this really awesome roof in Williamsburg. And then lo and behold, the next thing I know, like, Booker and Dax is doing the beverages, and they bring like liquid nitrogen, and like then all of a sudden, like, Danny Bowden shows up with like kind of spare ingredients, like the eel rolls. And this is right when he landed into town before. Like,
he's very hospitable.
It was kind of like, I was like, who's this guy who's wearing this white shirt with the weird colored hair standing in my kitchen? I mean, like, he was so nice, and it was one of those New York moments of like, it was just bonkers. So that's my
Danny's a sweetheart. I mean, that's why I think he's been so successful here. It's because he's like the nicest guy. You know? There's no pretense, and it's nice, you know. And
I met his baby. I met baby in Copenhagen.
Oh, cool. We are for man.
Have you been?
No, it always.
And he'd be really into that.
I always want to go. It always falls in weird timing for me. I mean, I always know when and it's the same time every year, but it's always something or other. I was going to go 1 year, and then
I'll see you there next year.
Maybe next year. Yeah, we'll try to go.
So you all work together at Bar Tartine.
Like, yes.
Not a lot of people know this really crazy, because a lot of interesting people and restaurants came out of that whole
experience. So Anthony worked with us, Danny worked with us, and then we left Bar Tartine. Chelina, my partner, business partner, Ian, who's another business partner, and works in the kitchen. So we and Anthony, we left, and, you know, kind of all talked about the kind of restaurant we wanted to have, and things that were important to us. I mean, charitable aspects, being creative, being unique, but also being affordable. And that was always, you know, that was always our benchmark. But, you know, I love fine dining. I eat at places all around the world, but they're a special occasion, and I can't, you know, the stuff I see for X amount of dollars, you know, I want to go to places where, you know, like you're saying, like Estella, like Pearl and Ash, where I can eat there on a more regular basis.
Tell me about one dish that you have on the menu right now, and like kind of how you came up with it, because I want people to know just how,
let's see,
you know, sort of zany and just wonderful. Like,
see, zany's fun. See, other people think it's always interesting, because I think we live in a bubble and perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, like our wine director and stuff, and where some people think things are zany and weird, it makes perfect sense to us. And it doesn't seem zany or weird, but to other people it seems like a weird combination. But we just, the way we look at food, it's just, we, you know, how it pairs, how it eats. Nothing seems zany. But that being said, there probably are zany things.
Well, it's fun to make it zany but make sense.
Zany but make sense, yeah. I like when people think are zany. I mean, that's, I don't want to say there's that X factor.
Yeah.
I mean, when we go out to eat, you know, like, I love.
Oh, yay!
Sorry to interrupt.
No, next.
Yeah, so this is our scallop crudo with mushroom escabeche.
Mm-hmm.
We take the trumpet mushrooms and peel them and saute them and marinate with sherry,
garlic.
Gosh.
sweet. And rice wine vinegar and all sorts of stuff. We let them sit almost for a month, though.
Oh, nice.
So they kind of, the pickle kind of matures and gets really, really rich.
What temperature do you have to sit at?
We keep them in the fridge.
Keep them in the
cold
fridge,
pickle.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah. Cold, yeah.
And then
let it just to really develop.
And some good fish sauce and little chili threads, lime zest, and cilantro stems.
And by the way, I'm just making him talk a lot, so this is more like because he's talking, you know, for my recording or show here. So,
okay.
So thank you for being a part of it. It's going to be such a rich. This is real life right here. This is happening.
This is what we do. We eat all the time.
Thanks, so chef.
Awesome.
I know. I'm making you talk with your mouth full. This sauce is amazing. This mustardy.
Yeah, I love mustard.
I love mustard.
Spicy.
Yeah. Okay, so your kids are 3 and 6.
Kids are 3 and 6.
Two girls. So are they good at food?
Youngest one is good at food. Oldest one used to be good at food.
Yeah.
Now she's in first grade. She's a little bit into the macaroni and cheese and chicken finger
stuff.
Which is fine. But she's actually gotten, knowing what I do, which she actually understands and respects. I'll get her to try things, but she'll say she doesn't like it. My youngest daughter,
like on purpose, she just has a
there's a point where she wouldn't eat anything, you know. Like they just get into like hot dogs and stuff.
God.
And then there's a point where now we'll just be like, because I think they're, from what I understand, they have so many taste buds that everything is, they're so sensitive that things are, you know, like we like spice and seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, it's just too much.
Okay.
It's just like, she came in one day, you know, we're having family meal, and they sat down, and, you know, and they, with my wife and one of my chefs made a pasta that was spicy, and she couldn't understand. She's like, why would anyone make anything like this? She's like, to her, it's so spicy. She's like, this is inedible. She's like, why would you make food for like this? She couldn't.
She said that, though?
Yeah, she couldn't understand. She was like, she started asking him. She couldn't comprehend, but it was too, because the spice is too overwhelming for her. So, like, her taste, you know, as a child, you have, your taste buds are much more sensitive, and then you try more things, and you sort of appreciate it a little bit more nuance and spice. But on the flip side, my youngest daughter likes pickles and olives and salty.
She's so cool.
She almost eats everything. And I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of creepy. I mean, that they'll eat sometimes good things, like, I mean, she likes caviar and stuff like that.
So,
but it's not a good habit. I wish it's an expensive habit.
I feel you. Well, I feel like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I already get excited about showing my little sis food. Like, you know, I took my little sis to 15 East, you know, my favorite sushi.
Yeah, boom, I've been there, boom, yeah.
I took her to 15 East for lunch. I did this thing where I was like, hey, girl, congrats on your internship to a successful summer. I want you to know what life can be like if you strive. You can be at 15 East. And I took her there for lunch. It wasn't really like a low-key lunch. It was more like a lunch where it was like essentially dinner.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just made my heart so
happy.
Of course she did. It like sharing, like, I don't mean, like, I'm saying something that's kind of a stereotypical thing to say, but when you share like food with someone that you like, you know, when it's family, you adore them with all your heart.
Yeah.
You know, and it just feels so wildly good.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, no, it's all about, I mean, those are the best meals you have, or when you have them with people, you know, you enjoy it. Like, I've eaten a lot of fancy meals by myself in weird places in the world, and they've always been fine, but when I've gone to places where there's, like, you know, many people and friends, those are always more memorable, and the food seems to taste better.
Why is it so fun to see, like, my little sister's reaction? Like, why is it, you
just
know,
a
I'm
shared reaction? Because I think it's just a shared reaction.
Or just, like, because she's a beginner at it.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know.
I think you're trying things for the first time, right? So she's, you know, you don't get to experience many things yourself again for the first time.
Okay.
So when you get to see other people experience things for the first time, you sort of share that again, you know? Because you're never going to have that first bite of foie gras. You're never going to have that first bite of perfect tuna. You know, the first time, you know, sushi. I used to eat sushi a little bit when I was younger, but then when I really went to better places and really first understood it,
yeah.
I mean, you transcend a little bit, and then but you still enjoy it. But then seeing someone else have that experience, I think, is enjoyable.
That's what I think. Except, that's why.
Yeah, but then they develop expensive tastes. There's a mixed feeling of having your children have expensive tastes, and they want, you know, foie gras and sushi all the time.
So your younger daughter, what's her name?
Emma.
So Emma is a caviar fiend.
Not a fiend. We don't give it to her enough, but she likes. She just seems to really like salty and pickly.
Okay, so she has like a bar tartine taste.
She's got a bar tartine. I should take her to. She's never been to the current incarnation of bar tartine, which I love. Yeah.
Debilitatingly good.
Yeah, I love. Yeah, I mean Courtney and Nick are those guys are
killing
awesome.
It.
Yeah. So they're but just that, you know, the fermentation, the salty, the pickly. Maybe we have I have a Eastern European heritage.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Where are your
I'm Russian Polish.
Okay.
So maybe somewhere those roots that have been muted and a little bit are showing up again. That sort of, I mean, every great culture though, or not, I don't want to say great culture, but food, I mean, likes that, like salty and pickly. You know, I think there's that common brown. I mean, there's
absolutely
a lot of Asian food, but there's the fermenting and curing, and then, I mean, Eastern European, there's a lot of fermented and curing. I think in this country, we've lost that taste for it a little bit. It's gotten a little bit bland, so I think now it's good. There's really been a countrywide rediscovering of all of that.
Really?
Have you been to a place lately where you haven't seen pickling and fermenting on the menu?
Oh, I love... Okay. So, in what way... I see it in fine dining and nicer restaurants.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's like pickling?
Yeah, I feel like I see it. I mean, I think San Francisco, we excel. I mean, definitely fine dining, but there's also that middle-level restaurant. And yeah, there's a lot of just a lot of that going on, you know, and everyone, it's been great because I think it's just part of people's pantry, you know, and it's not, you don't necessarily need to highlight it, but everywhere I go, there's always a little bit, you know, there's a fermented accent, there's a pickling accent. It's just flavor if you want.
Well, it's just the oldest school flavor and preserving something.
Everything went so new for a while, and then now it's, you know, everything's gone a little bit back to that, and then I think we're in that like post new and old phase, you know, where like food trends are going.
This is so fascinating. I'm gonna bring this back to my big corporate clients and tell them what we chefs and food people really think.
Interesting. I mean, I like, you know, that's, I mean, when you have something salty and pickly and craving, I mean, food that's alive, it's, you know, it's pretty awesome.
So, I would say your food is extra, extra umami full. You know, I like to, this is what I like to throw out. I'm like, people have an umami. So I have more of an umami tooth than a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
I
like umami more than sweet.
So do you think this is like, so everyone has that umami tooth, they just don't know how to define or even realize it yet? You know what I mean? Like, I kind of suspect this.
I think
Doritos.
Why are Doritos? Because why are Doritos good?
They're like umami little.
They're umami. Well, I think a lot of that, everything has been tested and chemically made to make you like it.
Yeah.
And I mean, things have been, I mean, all these, like, you know, I don't really eat fast food or Doritos or that stuff that much, but I understand that stuff's been like tested to make you crave it. There's salt, there's MSG, there's all that stuff.
Pretty creepy, right?
Which is creepy, but I mean, it's been designed in a lab for umami, and you know, that's why people crave that.
So would you say that do you just sort of accidentally make food, not accidentally, but you make food that is delicious that happens to be umami for, or did you at some point realize that's something that really floats your boat, you know?
We seek that out. When we do things, I look for balance in food.
Mm-hmm.
So everything we create has, you know, we look at is it's, you know, there's a little bit of sweet, there's a little bit of salty, there's a little bit of earthiness, there's a little bit of like a backbone to it. So like as we don't like things to be one note.
Yeah.
So we sort of look for, we like one note, we layer a lot of one note things to sort of get, you know, simple bites kind of layered into complexity, which we think kind of creates an umami, I guess. We like those flavors. I mean, those earthy flavors. And it's just, I think it's the, I don't want to say complexity, but it's kind of what we look for. It's a layering of flavors that we look for. And
so can I test a thought with you? I think, okay, so I've been making my Taiwanese beef noodle soup, and I call it hashtag Sue Soup, HSUSOUP. And just kind of big picture, like in the world of broths and stocks and soups and stuff like that, like, I don't want to, I'm put it, the Asian way, like, is more, is potentially more complex. I don't have the technical background to be able to, I'm just sort of throwing out.
I'm not really trained in Asian food. I just love it so much, and from eating it, that we looked at, we build a lot of flavors like that. There's the umami. I mean, there's also the slow building of broths when you're extracting that gentle flavor. I mean, soy is so full of umami if you're adding that. And then there's spice. And so there's that balance of like sweet, salty, spicy, which always kind of makes you think of those flavors.
Like to me, I just seek out the umami complex thing more than I do something that's in the French way properly seasoned.
Yeah.
So I don't know why.
I think it's a spice. I mean, partly spice. I mean, for me, I like spice. So I like things that make your mouth, I mean, you know, there's, you know, I love French and I love, you know, there's sort of a richerness to it. But then when there's something that's contrasting that and there's like spice, you know, so you have, you know, to me, I don't really like things to be clinging, but then there's always something that's like popping in there that makes it, you know, be it a spice, be it acid, be it herb.
Tell me one dish on your menu right now and what the components and just break it down for us.
One dish, one of our favorite things right now, we're doing an abalone dish. We just saute abalone. Then we do, it comes with different grains, some of them that we sprout, so that gets a little bit earthy and sweet. Some of them that, then we also pop those same grains. It comes with, we make a dashi, which we make out of shiitake. So we cook shiitakes for 24 hours at a really low temperature. And we let them sit in water for another 24 hours. And then to that we add kombu. And so it's this really light, long broth. And so it sort of has maybe an Asian sensibility to it, but then we drizzle brown butter over it. So it's kind of combining of like, not Eastern and Western, but there's really this clean aesthetic, but there's just like at the last minute this fat, you know, this fat that to us is sort of
take it up a notch.
Yeah, a hallmark of what we do. If we're not, you know, we want things to be clean and very precise, but then when there's just enough fat in there, that to us is what kind of hits that umami a little bit more. Where instead of just being, you know, really pristine, there's like just the right amount of fat to kind of coat
dial it up. Yeah. So what are your daughter's dream jobs right now, like at this moment, like what do they want to go grow up to?
They just want to be princesses.
Want to be princesses.
Yeah,
okay,
that's all there. They only know the princess lifestyle. My dream jobs for them are doctors and lawyers, but they know nothing but princesses right now.
Clearly, because that's all that they know.
That's all they know.
They're my precious daughters.
I don't know if they have their dream jobs right yet. But.
Well, I'll have a talk with them. I'll figure it out with them, for them. So, what about you? What's your dream job? Let's say you weren't a chef.
If I wasn't a chef, I don't know what I would do if I wasn't a chef. A marine biologist.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I like the water a lot. Oddly enough, eating things in the water. But,
you go fly fishing, right?
No, that's a friend of mine.
Oh, okay. That's what
you
talked to. Okay.
Yeah. When I used to have more time, I used to like dive a lot.
Oh, you did? Okay. So you have like your scuba.
A little bit, yeah. So.
Dive
but now,
off of the coast of San Francisco.
No, never. I've been in Thailand, Egypt, Mexico.
Egypt.
Yeah, I've been. Yeah.
What is
when
that?
When I was younger, I get to travel a lot.
Why?
Egypt is cool because you don't have kids and you have more expendable money.
Oh, okay, got it. Fantastic,
but,
noted.
And you don't have, you know, your own business that you're connected to, like buying a bilge cord every half an hour. I mean, I still get to sneak away every once in a while, but no, I love this sea.
Okay, last question for you. What's the diving like in Egypt?
Diving in Egypt is awesome. It's one of the best places. No, it's just crystal clear. You go in the Red Sea. I mean, the reefs are great. It's been around 10 years since I've been there. I was just trying to coolly list off all the places that I used to go to and think of fondly.
I'm a Pisces. I'm a good water person.
She considers herself. Well, my kids are. I mean, they're fish. They live. They love the water. We've done winter vacations, and they complain. And it's cold. Their mittens are soaked. And then we go like on. So, you know, we were just in Mexico, not just but in the summer, and like you know they don't get out of the water the whole time. I try to point out everything that's edible to them, and they have different thoughts on that. But we like the water.
Uni, your two daughters love uni.
They've tried it. I don't think they love it. I love uni. Uni is like uni. I mean, even at Bar 13, we always had uni. As long as we can get it, we always had uni on the menu. We tried to do more Western styles, or not Western style, but Western dishes, but that's something we've always had on. I mean, it's briny, it's sweet, it's creamy. I mean, to me, I don't know what, you know, it's very umami-ish.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I just had to ask that silly question just because it is such a...
Yeah.
ingredient of the...
Yeah, apparently...
Year.
It's, you know... Everything becomes ingredients of the year, and not to say we don't recognize what trends are, but we've been, you know, I've had it on my menu for the last 9 years, 10 years, and we love it, and, you know, I'm glad everyone is using it, unless they make it not available anymore over fish it. But, I mean,
Favorite ingredients? The right now, for you, just like what you're like so fascinated with.
Uni, fascinated with always. Seafood too, and shellfish whenever ending extent.
Just like one thing, very specific. Just something that has inspired you last week or whatever.
Last week, what's inspired me? Bone marrow. I was working on a bone marrow and abalone dish for New Year's. So
hell yeah, surf and turf,
a little pumpkin milk, pumpkin seed milk, and bone marrow.
That sounds phenomenal.
Some capers that we make from elderflowers that we've been finally able to use that we've been curing for the last couple of months.
That was just chef owner Jason Fox of Commonwealth in San Francisco, which just celebrated its 5th anniversary. They're any day now opening up Oro in the Mint Plaza. Yum. And you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leyte Sue, that's LEITIHSU. We're all at Heritage_Radio. And hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW, is how you can talk to us and we can find you. And I'd like to thank my regular listeners. You may have noticed that I've been mixing stuff up nowadays with how word of mouth sounds and feels. Summertime. So tell me what you hate and what you love and what questions you want me to ask and what you want to hear, because I'm lucky to spend time with these top chefs and food folks, and I get to share that with you. So this is the last show of the summer season. I'll take your feedback into account as we gear up for the fall. Lots of exciting guests like Michael Anthony and Jacques Pepin and Alex Dupac and Jordana Rothman, Magnus Nilsson coming up. So get subscribed on iTunes and Stitcher so you don't miss a thing. And after this quick commercial break, we'll wind it down live on the phone with Raimondo Boggia, the beverage director and managing partner of the Italian restaurants Obica Mozzarella Bar, Pizza and Kitchen here in the USA. They're international though. Before this, I want to let you know that he founded the first all-vegetarian restaurant in Italy called Gioia Alta Cucina Naturale in Milan, Italy, which got a Michelin star. And he's worked with the likes of Fiat, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Bulgari, Wow. Such an impressive resume. Today, though, we're going to focus on large format wines 101. Bigger is better.
Has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Thank you to our sponsor, Whole Foods. Without you, this show and everything we do at the network would not be possible. And now for Wine It Down.
Wine Down.
With Raimondo from Obica. Hello, Raimondo.
Hi, how are you, Liti?
Very good.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Obica is the place in New York to go get mozzarella of all stripes, shapes, sizes, and colors, and deliciousness. We got the smoked, we got the burrata, all of it's just coming straight from Italy. And then there's a lot of other stuff on the menu, too. So tell us a little bit about the food philosophy at Obica.
Oh, yes. We want to go back to nature, and in a era of celebrity chefs that we respect for many reasons, we want to go back to celebrity ingredients, because nature, especially in the Mediterranean, was so rich in history to brought to us a series of ingredients that in the United States are still quite new, now are becoming very popular, but not all of them yet. So the mission, if you want, of Obica in the world, not only in Italy, but in London, Tokyo, New York, Los Angeles, wow, where we are with our restaurants, is to bring the more, let's say, authentic experience we can of the contemporary Italian way of eating that is way more respectful of environment and of practice in agriculture that are not hurting the environment. And so we bring that freshness to New York as well in Flatiron District.
Absolutely. And worldwide, Obica has 20 locations, and then the Flatiron is where we're rolling out a large format bottle program. We're so lucky here. So,
oh yes, you know, the wine bottle has been designed progressively in history on that size that we all know, that is 3/4 of a liter, 24 ounces roughly, because it's convenient for family consumption in the traditional countries like France, Spain, and Italy, where wine is an everyday beverage at lunch and dinner. But for aging the wine, the large format is way better for at least three reasons. Mm-hmm. One is less oxygen in the bottle, so for the same amount of liquid, you have less oxygen, so you reduce the oxidation, the speed of oxidation, and the thicker glass that you need for a 3-liter bottle creates a darker environment inside and control the temperature better. So the jump up and down in temperature is an enemy of good aging for wine. Mm-hmm. The other one is the light, and the third one is oxygen. So with a 3-liter format, and we open one every afternoon at 3 p.m., so at 3 p.m. we open a 3-liter bottle, and usually it's finished, and, you know, after the happy hour time at 7, 8 is already finished, because people like the idea to have a glass of wine aged of a good quality that is, you know, preserved better than in a normal size bottle.
Oh, and it's just so much fun. The best thing, my party tip, bring a bigger bottle of wine. It's going to make you more popular.
Yeah, exactly.
And
no, I mean, you know that the names are funny with the big bottles, and so.
Oh, so funny.
Fish, yeah, tell me.
Can you walk us through each size and the name, because it's always something where we're like, is it a Jeroboam? Is it then? When is it a Nebuchadnezzar? Like, let's go through each of them and learn all of them together.
Yes, you know, as you know, I'm a certified sommelier. So in the official world of wine, even let's say from legal purposes, the only name that is official is Magnum, mm-hmm. from Latin, that means large. And Magnum is 1.5 liter or 2 bottle size. This is the only official recognized name. But in history, with authors that are not well phrased in the past, and so nobody knows exactly who created these names, and probably is not the same person, to tell you honestly. In history now, and in Champagne region especially, you have, you know, Jeroboam for 4 bottle size, Rehoboam for 6 bottle size, Methusalem 8, Salmanazar for 12, Balthazar 16, Nabucodonosor for 20, Melchior for 24, Solomon 28, Sovereign 33, and Melchizedek for 40 bottles. So, but, you know, that's. I think all this origin in the Bible and, you know, the old kings of the Old Testament and the New Testament and the old books and new books are have been given by you know, by people just for fun, I guess, and now they are becoming a little bit popular, but they are not official names, you know. That's should be said.
Oh, it's so fun. Where is the biggest bottle that exists today sitting? Like, I feel like I need to pull out my Guinness Book of World Records here.
Yeah. There is a Guinness record about a big bottle that I cannot guarantee, not the quality of the wine, not that I can see personally, but it has been done in 2011 in Switzerland and was made first, before saying the astonishing numbers, is made of Pinot Noir and Dorfelder, that is a local grape in Switzerland, a red grape. And the bottle is 12 feet high, tall, more than 12 feet, actually 12 feet and 2 inches tall, and 3 feet and 3 inches in diameter, and contains 533 gallons of red wine.
Wow.
You know, they made it to get the record done, and I cannot even tell you if the quality of the wine inside was great, but for sure they got a lot of news around them.
I have a similar problem in my home. For a rooftop party one time, I got from a friend who works for an importer this bottle of rosé, a massive bottle of rosé, and that was really cool then, but we never got around to it because, as always with food people, we have too much to drink, and so I never opened the bottle because it's so impressive and pretty. But then now I have this like big bottle of really old rosé, and I think I need it. I don't know, should I make like a big bowl of sangria or something?
You should taste it. You open, you know, in wine is a living system, so you should taste it. You never know. It's likely that a rosé cannot last as a good, well done, well prepared red wine.
Yeah.
But you taste it with friends, and if it's not perfect, you enjoy eventually cooking something or doing a sangria, as you say, or you know what else.
So at Obica, I guess you're pouring it. You're opening a bottle every day and pouring it by the glass, right?
Yes, and we do. We try to do it with the specific grapes that are not international grapes. So we are, as I told you, we like to be a little bit of divulgator of all the Italian complexity in wine. So we bring, Nebbiolo from Piemonte, but we bring two types of Nebbiolo. One is from the Barolo region that everybody know, and is a 3 liter of Barolo da Milano that we opened 2010. Or we can open from North Piemonte, a less known and reputed so far. In America, you call AVA, so it means American Viticultural Area. In Italy, we call simply DOC, so it's a denomination that is different, and is the DOC G Gattinara. Gattinara is not Piemonte; is a little bit more mineral, more harsh than a normal Barolo, with very educated tannins, and is a very great bottle Gattinara made by a woman winemaker that is named Cinzia Travaglini, and we pour that bottle as well. Another bottle that we pour is the Sangiovese from Tuscany in two versions. One is from a center of the Chianti Classico area. It's a super Chianti. It's called Flaccianello. It's quite expensive, but it's one of the best expressions in Sangiovese in the Chianti area, sub-area. Mm-hmm. Tuscany, and the other one is Sassalloro. Sassalloro is a Sangiovese Grosso whose grape is named Sangiovese Grosso BBS 11. BBS stays for Biondissanti, that was the father of Brunello di Montalcino, and this Sangiovese grows in Montalcino and is a specific clone, a DNA specific that only Biondissanti can produce, because it was a graft that he prepared with Sangiovese Grosso specific plants many years ago, and now he's the only one that produced this wine. So it's what the French call a monopole, and this Sassalloro is another phenomenal grape and phenomenal wine. And then we put Aglianico del Vulture from Southern Basilicata. Vulture is a volcanic soil, and so this Aglianico that they call the Nebbiolo of the South is a solid.
I love Aglianico.
You love Aglianico, the spiciness of the volcano,
it's
that is great.
Fantastic. I want to save time for my very last question, which is more practical. It's hard pouring out of these massive bottles, so tips for us at the restaurant and then at home.
Okay. So the 1.5 liter, the Magnum, a good professional sommelier should manage with one hand from the bottom, never touch the neck, and pour like a normal bottle. That's what we should do in a professional service. For home, you can, of course, enjoy managing with two hands if you feel more comfortable. At the restaurant, the 3 liter, even a good professional server, sommelier, is better use two hands and gently pour the first glass for, if you want, the entertainment part of the game. But for the real service at the table, we strongly suggest to craft the wine in a couple of carafes. Usually a 3-liter bottle is taken by table from 6, 8 to 10 people. So you open the bottle, you show the first pouring, and then you craft the wine. You get both the oxygenation of the wine that is better for aged wine, a little bit more than from the big bottle, and in the meantime, you help the customer to enjoy themselves with a big bottle as just a testimony of what they did, but without managing a big bottle that is not so easy.
With the lip as large as the lip of the glass, the glass is the same size as the lip of the bottle.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Raimondo, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, and come to taste the wine at Obica Flatiron.
That was just Raimondo Boggia of Obica, and you're listening to Word of Mouth. with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. We're live every Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern. This is the last show of the summer season, so join us back on Wednesday, September 16th. In the meantime, tweet at us, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. I'm at Leyte Su, LEITIHSU. Have a great rest of your summer. Ciao for now. Eat well. Be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.